help plot a terrorist attack on our nation's capital must be expelled. Likewise, Representative Cori Bush said on Twitter that the House must, quote, investigate and expel members of Congress who helped incite the deadly insurrection on our capital. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 61 degrees and partly cloudy with windy conditions. In New York City, it's 66 degrees and cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amar Evering.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Radio Gag, Gays Against Guns, and that is heard Tuesdays at 2:30 p.m. It is 1 minute past 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi coming up.
Greetings, greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to Black Star News Show on WBI 99.5 FM radio, also streaming on WBI.org. I am your host, Milton Alamadi, and today's show is devoted to you book lovers out there. We're going to have two fabulous artists reading from their works, and I guarantee you will enjoy today's session. And let me give you an important number as well. Listeners who want to ask questions of the authors, you can call this number, 212-209-2877. Once again, 212-209-2877. So I have with me today Felice Niels and Nana Ekua Brew Hammond, and they will be reading from their works. And before we get started, Nana, why don't you speak a little bit about the City Artist Corps grants and what role that's played in putting this event together.
Thank you so much, first of all, for having us, Milton. And I'm really excited. Thank you, Boogie Down Bronx Grind Cafe, for having us. So the City Artist Corps grant was a fund that was dispersed through the New York Foundation for the Arts. It was to help and support writers and artists who were impacted by COVID. So it was a lottery. You applied. There were three cycles, and I was blessed to be one of the people who received a grant. And as part of the grant was to part of the opportunity was to produce a reading in person, live, to get some of us off of Zoom and in person. So I'm really excited to be at Boogie Down Grind Cafe with Felice and Milton right now.
Okay, very good. So let me actually do you some justice by introducing you properly. Nana Ekwebrehammond, she's the author of Powder Necklace, which publishes weekly called A Winning Debut, named to the Africa 39 list of writers with the potential and talent to define trends in the development of literature from sub-Saharan Africa and the diaspora. Her short fiction was included in the anthology Africa 39. Her work also appears in Everyday People, The Color of Life, and New Daughters of Africa, among others. Forthcoming from Brew Hammond, or Children's Picture Book, a novel, and an anthology of works by African writers. Brew Hammond was a 2019 Edward F. Albee Foundation Fellow, a 2018 Ake Arts and Book Festival guest author, a 2017 Aspen Ideas Festival Scholar, a 2016 Hedgebrook Writer in Residence, and a 2015 Rhode Island Writers Colony Writers in Residence. Every month, Brew Hammond co-leads a writing fellowship at Manhattan Center for Faith and Work. So proper welcome to you.
Thank you.
And our next reader today is Felice Niels. She's an avid traveler, writer, language buff, film enthusiast, and photographer. She received her MA in Media Film Studies at the New School University in New York City in 2013, and her MFA in Creative Writing at City College, New York in 2018, where she began the journey with her current novel in progress. She's also the author of screenplays, short stories, travel narratives, and nonfiction essays. She's also the founder of RE, an ideas journal, and that's in parentheses and spelled R-E. Her work has been featured in various publications, including Catapult, Odyssey Magazine, Day One Literary Journal, and the New York Times. She is an adjunct assistant professor at the City University, at the City College of New York, CUNY, and works, lives, and pursues her dreams in downtown New York City. A proper welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so who gets to start? Whose work are we going to?
Felice is going to start.
Okay, Felice. And I want you to pronounce the title because I think I'm going to mess it up. Aww. Is it the 10 brr note?
Absolutely. Very good accent. Yes, the 10 brr note. Thank you.
Okay. Now, before you actually read, I was really fascinated by this piece because what you did is the story is based on the birr, and that is the currency of Ethiopia, correct?
Yes.
And you take this banknote, and this banknote changes hands multiple times, and throughout it is telling us a story. The hands that possess this banknote fleetingly, and then it moves on to the next individual. And through it, you also tell us a larger story of what is going on in Ethiopia, ultimately leading to the overthrow of Emperor Selassie himself, who himself actually also possessed the same banknote on at least two occasions. It's fascinating. How did you get this idea in the first place? Respond to that and then read us
Absolutely.
Whatever you want.
I will keep it short because this can be a long story.
Ah, okay.
But basically, on a trip to Ethiopia to see my extended family, I came home with this very battered 10 birr note. And I took a picture of it and I had it on my computer for about a year thinking I want to do a story about this note. What do I do? And I thought, why not create a story about how it got so weathered and the travels it has taken.
Right.
So that is the short story of this 10 burr note.
Okay, so let's listen to some sampling. And you know, every bit and part of it is fabulous. So you can read from whatever part you want.
Okay, I'll just start at the beginning and just read about 5 minutes worth.
Sure.
So the 10 burr note. The 10 burr note had made its debut in 1961, the year that the National Lottery was formed in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The lucky winner, Abrupti Bekele, scored a 21,000 birr win and placed the cash in the Bank of Abyssinia the day she walked out of the lottery office, keeping a few hundred on hand for this and that, that being the gold pendant she'd had her eye on since spotting it in the piazza on her way to her fabric store months before. Many complimented Brookthy on her fine necklace and tried to guess its weight and value. All knew of her sudden windfall, which was a hefty sum at the time for a woman who had moved to the city to sell her fabrics, noted for their fine weave and intricate patterns. She had poured her rural roots into every stitch and was glad for the customers who commissioned her for their wedding attire and fancy dress occasions. She had bought the lottery ticket on a dare. "Okay, but don't be too jealous if I win," she laughed and winked at the shoe seller, whose stall shared a wall with her shop. "Ah, you don't need the money. Look at your fine place," he said, stacking leather sandals and dusting off their. She had been lucky to have a benefactor from her village, one with whom she shared the pleasures of his bed, but not his desire to take it further. She had her eye on a hotel manager from the newly built Hilton in the center of town and found a way to be there often, a tea with friends, a tour of the rooms for a distant relative from Axum who would need a place to stay. The lottery winnings were hers alone, and this was a step toward the independence she had hoped for in the likes of a spanking new sofa and a boost in her savings account that would keep a roof over her head, should there be an unforeseen turn in her good fortune. The 10-burr note was pocketed by the jewelry store clerk soon after Brookthy deftly opened the clasp and slipped the fine gold chain around her slim neck, which had once been bitten by a widow spider while she slept in her village of Rira. The clerk had spent the small note on the bus he boarded along Jima Road and used the change for a pack of slim, cheaply made cigars. He had been keeping a bit here and there for himself since the owner of the jewelry store hired another clerk, which cut into his commissions and therefore his ability to swing the X. He was too smart for this line of work anyway, he thought, and for his next move, perhaps a job in government. It was a good time to get in their good graces, as Emperor Selassie's enemies were now in full view. Dawit, the palace driver, asked for change of 100 from his friend who drove a bus along Jima Road and kept the crispy new 10-burr note he received in the pile to give his boss. The emperor liked new bills, a sign of recovery and forward movement as the streets slowly turned to their normal hectic flow. The rebels had tried and failed to bring the government to its knees. The faithful kept the intruders at bay and greeted the emperor with open arms as the offenders, rather than surrender, took their own lives or were brought to trial. The driver distributed the older bills to the boys, who watched the car as he shooed a cow from the entrance to the barber shop, where he received a side trim and news from his fellow drivers and others in his rank. It had been suggested to the emperor by his supporters that he might squirrel away his most valued possessions and keep them there for the duration of his reign. He recognized the truth in this morning and placed large amounts of cash and jewelry within the hollow legs of chairs and books. The pounding in his chest began the day he ordered the hanging of Mengistu Noe, his brigadier general, head of the imperial bodyguard, ringleader of the two. But him, he admitted only to his wife and to close associates, completely off guard. Dawit delivered the daily papers and handed the emperor the 10-burr note with great ceremony. "Ah, this is a good one," the emperor examined it closely. He had admired the young woman who, drawn in red ink, held a knowing smile as she wove the traditional basket on the local side. That is the one where the number 10 was displayed in Amharic, the country's native tongue, since he was a small boy. She had reminded him of a princess in a story he had read. He'd imagined that he would be the one to save her from too much toil in the hot sun, and they would live in his castle where she would never again cut her finger on a stalk of straw. He decided to keep the note for luck in his wallet, for one he thought could always use more and never less good fortune. The pounding in his chest awakened the emperor the next morning. He considered adding the 10-burr note to his treasures, but instead consulted his ministers later that morning, who assured him that the unrest would not be repeated. The luck of the 10-burr note was soon forgotten and handed back to Dawit the driver, along with others in the amount of 10 and 20 to cover the cost of gas. Recognizing its crispness and disappointed in the emperor's lack of reverence for his effort, Dawit passed it along to the woman who approached his car selling newspapers and wooden statues of Christ.
Why don't we give him?
Wow.
Thank you so much, Felice. Your observation on her story.
I love it. I love this idea of using a note
of money to tell the story of a people, to tell the story of a country, what's happening. I think it is just, it feels so cinematic as well. Like I could just imagine it. I just loved it. I can't wait to read more. Is it part of a novel that you're working on?
That was my question. Thank you.
I have a novel that is separate that has just been completed.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But this is a part of a short story collection on traveling objects. So there will be a very different story and very different traveling object for each story in the collection. And this was the first one I wrote. Okay. I have a few more.
Okay, how many more? We can't wait.
You're very sweet. I have about four other ones, all over the world, objects, you know.
Okay, and then hopefully we get to hear more from those as well.
Well, I appreciate it, really.
So listeners, this is the point in the show where I remind you that WBI is 100% listener-supported. We don't take any ads. We don't take commercials. That's why we're free to bring you any type of conversation that we want and we like, and hopefully you like as well. But I do remind you, please support WBAI. You can pick up the phone and dial 212-209-2950. Any contribution will be put to good use. You can also adopt one of our buddy, in which case the money is taken, the designated amount is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. And hopefully Black Star News is one of the shows you select as a buddy. And you can do that by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBI.org. Now back to our fascinating readings today. Why don't we come to you, Nanai Kuabru Hammond. You wrote after it. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
This is, to me, it's really fabulous because it's a story that I can relate to and identify with. Your character,
Maunya,
tells us many stories. Here in the United States, she is in the margins of class, race, and we can feel that resentment that we all have experienced at some point. But yet when she is back in Ghana, she's actually part of the privileged elite. And in fact, regarded almost as a with some elements of Europeanness in her. If she gets to experience privilege, the privilege that she has had occasion to even resent while here in the US, and it's a very remarkable feeling, and also not only the privilege, but the advantages and even the, how should I say, abuse of that privilege in Ghana. And I know many Africans who go through that experience, and you are an observer, and you have probably known quite a few people who have gone through that experience. Was that a nice way to put it?
Yes.
Okay, so why don't we, why don't you read a little bit and then maybe we'll get, give you some reaction.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'll just take it from the top as well, read about 5 minutes worth and we can talk about it. Maunyo Hodasi woke up to the familiar pum of a tambourine, accompanied by the sharp vibrato of her father Albert's experimental therapy children's choir. Poor, abandoned, or ravaged by rare and pitiable diseases, the kids' voices rang without doubt. Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world. By now, Maunyo thought they had to know. Jesus' love notwithstanding, life didn't love them the same. The world loves some children more than others. But still they sang, employing all the elements of faith, desperation, determination, surrender, obedience, hope, in spite of life in the world. How's that gone away? I can't. Rich and poor, yes, everyone. Jesus loves the little children of the world. For years, Maunyo would roll her eyes at her father's earnest remix of the classic children's chorus as she watched the ragtag juvenile hospice chorals Albert started in different hospitals across Accra. Now, as she left her bed, she mouthed along, desperate for the song's heavenly truth to transcend the reality on the ground. Her heart pounding with self-loathing and relief. An 8-year-old was dead because of her. A little boy who, according to the death announcement posters plastered along Spintex Road, never even hurt a mosquito. Yet the sinking, throbbing shame she felt was shadowed by an irrepressible feeling of invincibility. In the immediate wake of the collision that had killed Edwin Ampa, Maunyo had not had to submit to questioning. There hadn't even been talk of a breathalyzer. There had just been her mother and father flanking her, leading her into their car. Thy Will, their driver, waiting at the wheel to take them home. Uncle John, her mother had started teasingly calling him Uncle Inspector after he was named Inspector General of Police, leading the way in his Land Cruiser. Every visit to Ghana, Maunyo railed at her parents' easy acceptance of the serf-like hierarchy that entrenched Ghana's caste system. She confronted them about how guiltlessly they paid their maid the equivalent of $40 a month, even as they gleefully did the math when their social security checks hit their accounts, simultaneously lamenting and rejoicing that the city's value had fallen again. 4.75 Ghana was $1 now. What can that buy? Tell me, her father complained. Because petrol was now 4.854 Ghana per liter, and the cars needed servicing, and the roads needed tarring, and the gutters needed rethinking, and the street sellers needed removing, and the government needed replacing because they were all chopping old. But now that her parents and Uncle John were handling this business directly with the boy's family, Maunyo went silent. She trembled when she remembered Edwin's blood seeping like water from a punctured sachet, pooling around his open face. She thought of Emmett Till, Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, and the countless blacks who had died without legal vindication. How many citizen justice petitions had she electronically signed demanding due process? How many Facebook posts and tweets had she liked and shared? In college, she had written reams of papers analyzing white supremacy and the psychology of white entitlement, righteously prescribing the need for white people to give up their privilege for true equality to be had. At church, she petitioned God for justice. Whatsoever you do to the least of my people, that you do unto me. She had sung through tears of transfiguration the morning before she had encountered Edwin Ampa. She had meant it all, still did, until it meant her. In that colorless hour between night and dawn, on the street without lamps just after the tunnel, when Maunyo felt her car slam into body, bones, organs, blood, soul, and cement blocks, and finally, a signboard advertising a new apartment complex with condos starting at $77,000 US. All she could think of was herself, her business, and the lone policeman at the checkpoint half a mile ahead. On ordinary nights, when they approached the officer on the way home after an evening out, her father would suck his teeth. If I refuse to stop, he has no car to chase me, Albert would say. All he can do is radio the next checkpoint. He is powerless to do anything but collect bribes. Her mother would blink as she always did when she was faking a smile, then dutifully push the overhead light on and tilt her head out of the car as the officer shined his flashlight inside. Ochina, me di something small, but mao. Why? Harmless flirtation, Rosemary translated for her daughter. Complicity is the engine of corruption, Maunyo would respond. But that was B.E. Immediately after Edwin, adrenaline numbing what she later realized was her broken nose, Maunyo mentally counted the notes in her bag. She would give the checkpoint officer something big if it came to that. She had not made the rules, she told her protesting integrity, and the rules would not be overturned because of her. No sense in allowing the levers of a warped system to churn her up before she had the option of exemption. This was the pernicious privilege Maunyo had picketed in college and sermonized her parents about. And she, young, black, female, born in America, born of Ghana, had the shadowy powers that be on her side. She was the euphemized man.
You know, bravo. I mean, what I like the most is she's such a relatable character, right? And yet she's telling herself she did not make the rules. That's not what we tell to white supremacists or other European Americans who take advantage, right? And perpetuate the abuses that we see that have gone on for decades and even for centuries. So it's amazing that you can see how it's easy to condemn privilege, criticize privilege, until, you know, the privileges that you find yourself suddenly enjoying. And that, I think, also because it tells a big story about people that sacrifice, step out of their zone, and forsake privilege in order to, you know, commit to the struggle. So that was my reading. I was seeing multiple scenarios as I read your piece and as you read it right now and as I'm listening. I don't know if you want to respond to that, and then we'll have Felice also give her take on this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, it's something that I noticed when I would go to Ghana is the power of the dollar, the respect that was accorded to me and afforded to me because I had a blue passport and because I had, you know, dollars. And I started to realize that there was something wrong with the system, something wrong with the way things were going down. And I really wanted to examine it because I think that it's, and I talked to a lot of friends from different African countries and, you know, some of the ways that, you know, I would hear the way people would speak of people who were born in the countries that we come from or people who are living in those countries and are poor, the ways that they would speak of them sounded very similar to the ways that we hear, you know, white supremacists speak about Black people.
Right.
And it made me want to really examine and explore this as something that we need to take ownership
of course.
And examine within ourselves, because maybe it's not just a Black and white issue, but maybe it's a human issue that we need to deal with.
Absolutely. And that's where the class angle to me was also playing a very big role as I was reading and reflecting upon your writing. Please, Felice.
Yeah, just a quick word. I mean, I love the story. And also, there's this kind of double consciousness, right, that we always go through, whether it's double consciousness in our own, you know, culture, double consciousness in New York, going to our quote-unquote home country and feeling a part of it and yet not. Mm-hmm. And this is what I loved about your piece. I also love the music, use of the music. It's just so powerful. And as always with your work, it just brings your rich settings to life always. But
Thank you.
So we have the same question for you. Is this part of a longer a novel, or is it also going to be a collection?
It is part of a novel in progress. What I'm reading appears in New Daughters of Africa. But yes, I am. It's definitely something that I'm working on as a full length book to really examine this, take it to the hilt.
Right. Where are other settings that the story, because obviously right now we're listening to this scene is in Ghana. Where else are?
Well, it's as far as I know right now, as I'm working on it, it's going to be fully set in Ghana, but it brings a lot of these questions of what it is to have a Ghanaian American identity. Mm-hmm. So she faces a lot of interesting situations where she is always feeling like, you know, I just when I think I've got this Ghanaian thing down, I'm American, and how she plays both sides. And I think that's something too that we need to talk about, like how easy it is to kind of slip in between these two consciousnesses, as Felice just pointed out, to our advantage and to our benefit.
Okay, could you remind listeners who may have just tuned in of your other titles that are published and how they can get, I suppose, Amazon?
Yeah. So you can, New Daughters of Africa was published by Myriad Editions in the UK and Amistad in the US. So you can go to their websites and purchase the books there. This is, as I was saying, what I read is an excerpt from New Daughters of Africa. I also have a short story in the collection Accra Noir, which is published by Akashic Books. So you can go to their website as well. Akashic is spelled A-K-A-S-H-I-C. I also have my debut novel. It's called Powder Necklace. It was published by Simon & Schuster's Atria Books, Washington Square Press. So you can get that also online. And a few other things that I can't remember right now.
Oh, that's good. That's prolific output. When we all like to be in that position.
Well,
no, that's great. And you, could you remind Felice where people can also get some of your published work?
Sure. So my work, no books yet. However, I do have work in Catapult, two different travel pieces in Catapult, one set in the U.S., and the other in the United States, also in Medium, an essay, I'll just call it a slightly humorous essay, and I have a tiny love story in the New York Times.
Ooh. Okay. Okay, now in terms of the 10 bitter note, and I know Ethiopians are saying, what is wrong with this guy? Why is he mangling this stuff?
No, I love it.
But you say it's going to be part of a collection, but to be honest with you, I was hoping there would be more and that this would become a book.
Well, I'm honored, actually. Thank you. When I workshopped this for my MFA program in my writing group, anyone who's listening, I hope it sounds better now. I have worked on it. I got that a lot, but I like this idea of transience,
okay.
Right? And
absolutely.
We meet these people and then goodbye.
Yeah, right? That makes sense.
It's
too.
A risk, but.
That makes sense. Okay, so now we're at the midpoint of today's show. And we take a short break, and then we'll be back for the second half hour. Take it over, Reggie, at the studio.
All the problems, all the things what we think say you could do for this world, it start when the teacher, schoolboy and schoolgirl jam together. Who be teacher? I go let you know. Who be teacher? I go let you know. Who be teacher? I go let you know. Start to walk,
government be teacher.
Who be government teacher?
Culture and tradition.
Who be government teacher?
Culture and tradition.
Culture and tradition.
All right, greetings again, sisters and brothers. Welcome to the second half hour of Black Star News Show on WBI 99.5 FM New York Radio. Also live streaming on WBAI.org. I am your host, Milton Alimadi, and today's show is devoted to you book lovers out there. I have with me today Nana Ekwuebru Hammond, and she's been reading from her works, and we'll get to listen to some more in the remaining time we have on this show. And also have Felice Niels with us, and she's also reading from her work. Welcome back to the second half hour to both my guests.
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay, excellent. So why don't we start with you this time? Nana, why don't you read from your work, and we'll give you some feedback, some reaction, and then we'll also hear from Felice.
Okay, great. I'm going to read, just going to continue reading from this story. So here goes.
And please remind people that may just be tuning in right now the title of your work.
So the name of the title is After Edwin, and it is about a Ghanaian American woman who has unfortunately killed a young boy in a vehicular accident, and she didn't suffer any legal recrimination for it because of her class. And so this is where she is.
And the irony is that while she is here in the U.S., she's a critical observer of the privileged class here in the United States. Okay, go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Milton. So I'll continue. Maunyo's status in Ghana had initially confused her. In the United States, Maunyo had grown up certain of her place, inferior to whomever was white or rich. And she had spent the better part of her adolescence doing everything she could to achieve proximity to both. Among her first-generation American classmates from Haiti, Jamaica, Guyana, Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, Colombia, and Ecuador, she aggressively befriended the ones with the loosest curls and the straightest waves, the ones light enough to have freckles on their skin. She modeled her vocabulary, mannerisms, and tastes after white book and screen characters. She styled her freshly relaxed hair in cascading waves she regularly tucked behind her ears or tossed over her shoulders. She developed an obsession with golf, tennis, and surfing. She wrote the hell out of her college application personal essay, conspiring with every exoticized notion of Africa she had seen or read, separating herself from all but the talented tenth of blackness, campaigning as the ideal thank you so much for this opportunity and financial aid candidate to secure a spot in one of the best of the whitest of schools, and she made it. She was accepted by Smith College, that old bastion of wealthy white femininity, where the daughters of slaveholders and suffragists converged in the intellectual mother of all finishing schools. It was the largest sister of the seven. Radcliffe, Vassar, Barnard, Wellesley, Mount Holyoke, and Bryn Mawr completing the number reserved for the richest, whitest, historically women's colleges in America. But at Smith, she discovered more than how to be better at becoming an internally inebriated, feminine mystique quoting white man's wife, should she be so lucky. Over 4 years of nailing her role as the stylish, intellectual, worldly, grateful, hardworking Negro, she found she wasn't the only one playing a part. When the lights lowered or drinks were served, when the music came on, she realized her white friends had been doing their own studying. Rapaciously singing along to whatever hip-hop track was the banger du jour, they always knew exactly when to go silent when the notorious N-word appeared. In photos, they threw up gang signs they had seen in films or pictures, smiling at the irony, and captioned them with shrugging or marijuana leaf emojis. Watching them perform what had been presented to them and the world as contemporary blackness, it dawned on Maunyo that her performances were minstrelsy too. There was no white or black way of doing or being. Whiteness and blackness were fabricated labels for invented identities, pernicious distortions of peoples and cultures to fossilize power and make money. Race was make-believe, and it was crushing every actor. Whites were existentially undone by the masquerade of superiority, even and especially when they didn't know it to be a sham. They were nagged by the anxiety that comes with unmerited privilege, the fear that at any moment the ruse would be discovered and everyone would stop playing along. They were bland with the ignorance born of segregation and separatism, pickled by a legacy of myths their forebears had created to uphold their dominance, a fairy tale that preserved them as uniformly powerful and rich when most were actually struggling. But still, it was better brine than the one everyone else marinated in, and therein the privilege lay and lied. Meanwhile, people of color, blacks, Asians, Latinos, mixed races, were caged by the systematic invalidation of their identity and dignity, the severity of it moderated by their perceived proximity to whiteness. To survive and also to thrive, they were consigned to the schizophrenia of simultaneously inhabiting themselves and having to refute or play up some aspect of the many facsimiles of themselves permitted or peddled by white culture. And they were reminded again and again that neither wealth nor extreme talent, intelligence, beauty, interracial coupling, acutely articulate addiction, not even self-hate, offered total immunity. Whether shopping under the surveillance of a following white eye, house hunting in a white neighborhood, or looking for a date online. Every hand, every color was cuffed by this concept that had flowered from a conspiracy of evil imaginations and financial interests into an evergreen global institution. Everyone was victim of it, and victims cared first about turning their own fortunes around, even if doing so victimized others. How ironic, yet apt, the term race, Maunyo often mused, set up so no one would ever be able to outrun it. Then Maunyo went to Ghana for a visit. Her first as an adult after her parents moved into the house they had built with their 401ks to spend the rest of their lives in. Speaking and thinking like the Ghanaian American she was born and raised to be, half of her identity was dismissed and Maunyo was summarily painted an Obruni, white. With the almighty dollar in her pocket and a blue passport in her name, she had the power to make grown men beg to carry her things. And she had the freedom, no humiliating visa interview to endure, to escape the survival mode settings in Accra was permanently on anytime she chose. It was intoxicating. Suddenly, Maunyo inhabited a position America had made clear would eternally elude her, rich white girl. Inspired by the wealthy white friends she had made at Smith, she played the good one to perfection, born for the role of conscious, righteous, endearingly tone-deaf advocate. Before Edwin, she had begun to drop parts of her act. After increasingly regular jaunts in Ghana, Maunyo began experiencing emotional jet lag when she returned to the States. In Ghana, she was the head. In America, she had to keep her head down and tuck her proverbial tail. Formerly, code switching titillated her. She was a natural actress, and she took pride in her mastery of the subtle performance. But her one-time amusement at playing to the room, adapting herself into palatable to the myth of whiteness, depending on the crowd, fermented into an acrid resentment. Deep anger slowly began replacing her need to be validated and affirmed by white people. After Edwin, there could be no more pretense. Just as there was nothing inherently better about the white people or rich people she had been raised to worship, and nothing inherently worse, there was nothing good about the passive righteousness she practiced when she was in Ghana. There was just hypocrisy and her conscious decision to love herself more than her neighbor.
Oh, a round of applause. You know, the more I listen to you reading from your work, I'm thinking, you know, when I read like Frantz Fanon, for example, right? That's, of course, you know, nonfiction. There's a lot of psychology involved. There's a lot of history, class issues, race. And as I'm listening to you read, I'm experiencing the same kind of situation, only this time you're using the technique and craft of fiction to actually convey the same type of lessons. And, you know, clearly this work is for to read. And also I like the term, the proximity to whiteness, even though many European Americans are struggling as well. But there's that absurdity behind the whiteness. And as I'm listening to you, I'm reminded of one incident that actually just a few days ago I told my students about. And this incident occurred like many years ago. I'm walking on Broadway around 103rd Street, a very bitter cold day. So cold, I didn't want to take my hands out of my pocket because I didn't have my gloves on. Then I come upon a panhandler, a European American. And, you know, he asks for money. And I paused, I hesitated. Actually, I think I stopped. And I was about to take my hands out because I had some money in my pocket. I had some change. Then I said, damn, it's so cold. I'm sorry. I don't think I'm supposed to say damn. Oops. Okay, excuse me, WBI listeners. I didn't mean that. But anyway, I said, I'm not going to take my hands out. Why? Because even when I put it back in, it's going to be too late. Frozen. So I said, sorry, and I walked by. And guess what he said?
What did he say?
Just guess. Obviously, he's angry. What could he have said?
I don't. Did he curse you out?
The N-word.
Oh.
So think about it. This is a guy of no means, you know, asking for money. He didn't get it, but he's using that whiteness as something that he actually holds as something that still allows him to be somehow above me. So the incident came back to mind. I was listening to what you were saying.
Wow, I was not expecting him. I thought he would just curse you out, F you.
He said the N-word. I turned around and said, listen, I'm going around the corner to the post office. If I come back and you're still here, I don't think it's going to be good for you.
Good for you.
Wow.
Thankfully, he wasn't there because I might have ended up being in bigger trouble. But anyway, what's your reaction to what you just heard?
I lost my thought after that story. But, you know, it just reminds me in a weird way of that twist in Bonfire of the Vanities where they hit this kid in some, you know, quote-unquote desolate neighborhood in New York.
Right, in the Bronx.
In the Bronx, okay. Wealthy couple. And the whole thing is about, okay, how can we get away with this?
Exactly.
Right. And your story is not Bonfire of the Vanities, but it just reminded me of that privilege.
Yes.
Covering up, right? This horrible deed. Right.
Yep.
That's an aside. What I really wanted to say was that with what you just read in particular, just again, the whole idea of playing these roles, right? And again, we all have our roles, but it's so relatable. Even if you're not, you know, person of color, this and that, it's relatable into how we play roles all the time on some level, right?
And how relative privilege really is.
And how relative, exactly.
You know, because we don't see ourselves sometimes as the privileged class because, you know, obviously there are a lot more people that we look and sometimes critique. But, you know, I guess the key lesson here is try to take yourself outside your immediate zone sometimes. And I think a lot of people in this country actually need that, to be honest with you.
I agree.
Maybe your book will help in that process. So listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM Radio, New York, also live streaming on WBAI.org. I am your host, Milton Alimadi, and we're listening to some fascinating readings from works of fiction from our two guests today, Ananai Kwebru-Hammond and Felice Nils. Listeners, as we wind down today's program, I remind you one more time, we are listener-supported 100%. No commercials, no ads, and that's how we can have the privilege to bring to you these types of conversations that you can only listen to on WBAI. So let me remind you to pick up the phone and dial 212-209-2950. Any contributions to WBAI will be put to good use to bring you these programs. And you can also do something else. You can adopt one of the shows or more on WBAI as a buddy, in which case the money that you designate is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. And obviously we hope Black Star News Show is one of those shows. And you can do that by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBAI.org. Now back to our guest for the remaining time we have on this show. So Felice, why don't you read a little bit more from your work and we will give you some of our reaction and feedback.
Sure, I'd be honored, thank you. So the 10 burn note continues.
And for listeners that came in late, they may not know what a 10 burn note is.
This story is about a 10 burn note, which is Ethiopian currency, and how this note has gone from one hand into the other. And now we are we will begin the third hand that it will reach.
Right, and she is doing a disservice to her wonderful story. And each time it exchanges hands from one hand to another, there's a fabulous story related in each stage of this exchange of this privileged banknote.
Thank you so much, Milton. The rainy season did not help business, especially the fog. The 10-bur note was folded in a small square that held the wooden statue of Christ in place on the dusty dashboard of the Jeep. Tesfai touched the statue and murmured a few words to his savior as he steered the Jeep around the bend. He was glad he had stopped to purchase the carving from the woman on the road in Addis all those months ago who had given him the 10-bur note in change for his purchase. He would need its guidance to get him through the mist that consumed the pencil juniper and St. John's wort on either side of the mountain's narrow pass. The Jeep inched through the thick cloud that had overtaken the road, bringing them dangerously close to the precipice. The group of tourists was silent as Tesfai navigated the sheer drop on his right with the help of a passenger who pointed left and shouted "Ja" in Danish when it was safe to go forward. They had arrived at the inn hours later, thanking Tesfai for his calm ingenuity and shaking their heads at the fog, which all felt very lucky to have made it through in one piece. An American tourist who had been told of the harrowing ride along the mountain where the Jeep had barely missed a mule and his owner in their cart only inches away, leaned forward, gripping the seatbelt on her shoulder. "Can you see anything?" Tesfai rolled the window and wiped the side view mirror with his hand. "We're okay, miss. It's not like the other day." The tourist, relieved, sat back and took in the view that stretched along the Balay mountain range. The eye of the fog had thinned and allowed for a glimpse of the village miles ahead, marked by beds of kale and wildflowers. "That was quite a trip, I hear." The tourist removed her camera from her knapsack. Tesfai smiled and patted the head of the statue. "We had help, miss." The 10-bur note dislodged by this reverent gesture, for the first time since its placement under the statue, landed beside the tourist, who unfolded the bill with a girl in russet red ink and her wheat,
now had a line that ran through the middle where the paper had been folded and pressed. Want to swap? Mine might hold this better. The tourist retrieved a bill of equal value and placed it under the statue. Sure, I'm a Secanalo. Tesfai turned onto the village road and waved to his friends who prepared their lunch under the open canopy. The tourist tucked the 10-bur note in her pocket and steadied her camera. Think they'd mind if I took a photo? Tesfai stopped the jeep and waited for a mule to cross the road. I'm sure it's fine, he said as he moved to greet his friends. A child in a pink cotton dress and headscarf wandered to the tourist side of the car. Well, hello, the tourist reached out to shake the child's hand. The child laughed and extended hers shyly. What a pretty dress, the tourist smiled. Tesfai waved from the other side of the road. It's okay if you want to take her picture, miss. Her father is here. The father nodded. The tourist removed the 10-bur note from her pocket and handed it to the child. This is for you. The child shook her head and ran to her father. Tesfai walked to the car. She cannot accept any money unless you are buying something. They are selling Goldman. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean... The tourist returned the camera to her bag. Goldman would be fine. Tesfai waved to the father who brought a bag of fresh kale to the tourist. Thank you, she said, handing him the 10-bur note. Don't worry, Tesfai smiled as he returned to the car. He knows that you are a foreigner. The tourist sank into her seat, suddenly feeling the weight of her red hair, sun-drenched freckles, and Midwestern roots. The father waved goodbye to the jeep as the 10-bur note slipped from his hand and into the stream that led to the main road 2 kilometers away. Befitsum wendita sete, the child shrieked and chased the note along the water. The father grabbed her hand. The burr had moved too quickly. The father sighed and explained to the child that sounded and it would make them happy. He would not tell his wife that he had carelessly lost what could have been a homemade meal for one. The 10-bur note rested against the muddy bank where the cow drank and waited for its master to complete his business with the owner of the small hotel. The owner pointed to the cow. I will have your money. Let her be, Gazoo blew on his fingernails, as was his habit when caught in a maze of deception and anger, usually of his own making. I will keep the animal until I am paid, the owner walked toward the cow. Gazoo blocked his way. Where is my money? Gazoo stood triumphantly while hiding his shaking hand in his pocket. She deceived me. I was ready for a night of full satisfaction, and she only rubbed her hand there. He looked down at the zipper on his pants and lifted his head quickly. I will not pay for mediocre service. The owner rushed toward Gazoo and circled his slim neck with his hands. She is my best girl. You will pay 300 bur. More would have been double. The owner released his grip. Tomorrow, or my boy will take care of it. Gazoo coughed, checked his throat for irreparable damage, and nodded his head. The owner, satisfied that the cowman would cause no further interruption to his already hectic day, hurried toward the pink facade of the Sheba Hotel to greet an incoming guest. Gazoo had been prepared to offer the girl 100 bur for a few hours of contrived passion and physical pleasure, but more than that would break him. He had exceeded the sum of his earnings as it was, owing the chaat seller for his indulgence of the week before, and the rent was approaching for the cow stall and his lodging. He would run away to the city. The owner would not bother to find a worthless cowman in such a place. Satisfied with his plan, Gazoo spat on the dusty stones and slapped the cow on its backside. The cow remained fixed to the muddy patch. Come, you stupid animal, Gazoo reached for the cow's leather collar and spotted the 10-bur note stuck. He dropped the collar and looked to the right. It was a good omen, he thought, and packed the soggy burr in his pouch. The 10-bur note had made its way into the back pocket of a gambler with a cow as he walked on the Bole road. The man and the cow, who was pulled with great force by the bully onto the side of the road, prompting a seer moo from the beast, seemed to be the unlucky recipients of this heinous act. The gambler, who owed many, including his cousin and a local policeman, saw no harm in extracting what he could from the that had fallen on the shadier side of the altercation and went unnoticed.
Applause.
Thank you.
Okay. I mean, I can't add anything else.
Yeah.
I I'm so biased. I want more. I want more of this. I find it so fascinating. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. No, I love you get so immersed in each of the different stories. Like this tourist giving this child, this money, the white guilt of that. And then we, you know, then we see the money flying, and then you're immersed in a completely different situation. And it's almost like, you know, you hear people say, if these walls could talk, but it's like, if this bill, like, you think about, like, the money that you have in your pocket and how many hands it's changed.
Right. That's right. That's why I said the bill was eavesdropping at every stage.
It is a character for sure.
It's a brilliant device. I think it's so brilliant.
Oh, I appreciated this, both of you.
Right. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you a little, just like, as a writer nerd question,
Totally.
But like, what did you find challenging about making this, this note a character in and of itself?
I mean, continuity, for sure. Like, early draft of this was, okay, wait, is it making sense where this currency is going? Because I want all of these characters to somehow fit into this story.
Right, of course.
You know,
right.
So that was one of them.
Very cool. Very cool. I love it.
So as we wind, we're actually running out of time now. I just have one question for each one of you. What is the writing process for you? Do you think out the entire work before you start writing, or a substantive part of it, and then the rest comes later?
I think for me, it happens in different ways at different times, but with certain projects, it could be something like an idea that, like, for example, with this story, it was just something that had been weighing on my mind.
Right.
Sometimes it's an article that I read. Sometimes it's a conversation that I have. Mm-hmm. Someone that I see on the street, like, I'm interested in that man who gave you the N-word.
Yes.
Like, he's a story in and of himself.
I agree.
You know? So things like that inspire me. And I don't usually lay out a full understanding of the whole story. I like the story to reveal itself to me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's exciting, actually, too.
Yeah, I fully agree with my book, which is my first novel. It's historical fiction, so what attracted me to that was a lot of history and creating fiction around history. That's like a thing for me, is sort of manipulating real stuff. And then with this, and with this collection, objects. I'm obsessed with objects and photography, so...
All right, so unfortunately, we're having a fabulous time. Hopefully, listeners, you too, you're enjoying this conversation, but we've run out of time. Tell listeners, you first, Nana, how people can get in touch with you, and then you, Felice, if they want to continue conversation.
If you want to continue the conversation, you can find me. My website is probably the best place to have everything. That's nanabrewhamond.com.
And for me, Instagram is a good place. I'm at Violet Running Water.
I love it, Violet Running Water. That's all the time we have, listeners. You can follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter. You can also please visit blackstarnews.com. Remain safe. Remain Pan-African. See you next week.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. Yesterday, the civil trial involving several of the white supremacists who helped organize the deadly Unite the Right rally in 2017 in Charlottesville, Virginia, has started. Seven jurors were selected in a civil lawsuit against the organizers of the 2017 Unite the Right rally. The plaintiffs accused the 24 organizers of intentionally instigating the violence that left them injured. The 24 defendants, including white supremacists, neo-Nazis, Klan sympathizers, and 10 far-right organizers, have argued that they were acting in self-defense. Lawyers for the 9 plaintiffs who are injured will argue that the defendants violated the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, a Reconstruction-era law that contains a rarely used provision that allows private citizens to sue other citizens for civil rights violations. The case is the first major civil suit to be tried under the Reconstruction-era law in years and could provide a model to hold those accountable who incite right-wing extremist violence. A rare judicial inquiry began on Monday into the killing of Eric Garner, a 43-year-old black man who was choked to death in 2014 during an arrest for allegedly selling illegal cigarettes. NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo put Garner in a chokehold that had been banned by the department since the 1990s. Garner told the arresting officers, quote, "I can't breathe," more than 10 times before he became unconscious. He was left lying on the sidewalk as the cops waited for an ambulance to arrive and was later declared dead at the hospital. Pantaleo was fired for his actions 5 years later, but he never faced criminal charges. No new charges are expected as a result of the new hearing, which Garner's family sought and the city opposed for years. Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, says it's an opportunity for clarity and accountability. An FDA expert advisory panel is meeting today to discuss whether or not to approve the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. The committee is reviewing research from Pfizer BioNTech and trials in that age group to decide whether the vaccine's benefits outweigh